This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Sona Chattai, thank you for joining me.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for hosting me.
You've written like a bunch of books about modern Turkish politics and quite specifically focused on Prime Minister and President Erdogan. So I'd like to know, how has he changed over the time you've been studying and how has your view of him developed?
That's correct. Indeed, I've followed the career of Turkish President Erdogan for just about two decades now. I got hired after my PhD at Yale by the Washington Institute in 2002, September to be precise. Erdogan's party, Justice and Development, known as AKP, came to power in November that year, just 2 months after I took my new job. And just about two decades later, I have been following his career over the years. Of course, Erdogan has changed, I think, and my analysis of Erdogan has moved along with that. There was a time during the first decade of Erdogan in power when his signal achievement was quite phenomenal economic growth. Improvement of services, and I gave him credit for that. I wrote an entire book devoted to that called The Rise of Turkey. This was about the dramatic economic transformation that Erdogan delivered. But I was always, I think, quite skeptical of Erdogan's political agenda at home and internationally. Indeed, there was a time when I was alone in the analytical community. A lot of people focus simply on the economic part of the story and ignore the political part of it. So I have also written on the political part of Erdogan's legacy, including the new Sultan, where I have looked at his populist and nativist policies at home. Now, nearly two decades into his rule in Turkey as prime minister first and then president, and then as executive style president, Erdogan has not only increased and consolidated his political powers, but I think he's very different than where he started. You know, when he started, his vision, at least statedly, was taking Turkey into the EU, making it a liberal democracy. Now, not only is Turkey quite far away from that vision, but I think increasingly Erdogan is has gone, in my view, over the height of his popularity domestically. And regardless of what he does, it doesn't look like he's going to be able to build that base that so adoringly loved him and supported him. And I think, Luke, what it goes down to is really the economy, which is Erdogan's Achilles heel. He built a base that loved him, that at one time made up just about half of the electorate, primarily because he delivered phenomenal economic growth. He increased access to the pie, improved services, a factor that I love most from my first book on the Erdogan years in Turkey, The Rise of Turkey, is that when Erdogan came to power, infant mortality rate in Turkey was comparable to pre-war Syria. That's pre-war Syria. Now it is comparable to Spain. So the fact that he has improved access to services, living standards, is the main reason why the base loved him. And this is the key reason why the base is now abandoning him. The Turkish economy went into recession in 2018. It's the reason, the key reason why Erdogan lost elections for mayor elections for Istanbul, Ankara, their big cities in 2019. The economy has exited recession, but it's only showing signs of slow growth. And there are other problems that compound Erdogan's ability to rebuild his base, which I can elaborate. The most significant of one, of course, is demographic trends that are working against him. But overall, I think Erdogan is in the autumn of his political career. It's going to be hard for him to build this amazing popularity that he once enjoyed. And so I think that we're witnessing a new era in Erdogan's political career. He may have gone through the height of his popularity. And the issue now, of course, how does he deal with lower levels of popularity and support and yet maintain control over a country that has robust and old democratic traditions?
So I think you're completely right to highlight the economy as sort of his great achievement, and his decline in popularity, it tracks pretty nicely with the decline in value of the Turkish lira. You can kind of map them together, I think. However, I don't think Erdogan's appeal is simply economic. There's also a strong identitarian side to why his supporters are so loyal. So do you see that changing as well, or is that as solid as ever?
That's correct. I think Erdogan has two sides. There's a bright side, Erdogan who delivered growth, improved access to services, improved living standards. But there's also a darker side of Erdogan, the nativist populist leader. Indeed, I believe Erdogan is among the inventors of nativist populism politics globally, together with perhaps Hungarian leader Orban, a model that has been copied effectively by other leaders in Europe and beyond. The idea that, you know, only voters for a specific leader are the true children of the country, and everybody else is contaminated in quotes, liberals, quotes, imported or working for foreigners or whatever adjective you want to use. That was Erdogan's brand, especially in the second decade of his reign in Turkey, starting from around 2010 up to this day, he has created this imagery that only those who vote for his AKP are true Turks and good Muslims, and anybody else who does not do so is neither a true Turk or a good Muslim. And I think that kind of nativist rhetoric has been copied by other leaders. But there's also another element to Erdogan's nativist populism, that is anti-elitism. Erdogan, again, like nativist populist leaders globally, has blamed the country's elites for its problems and said that he would solve them. There was a time when this elitism was anti-elitism was believable, the first decade of Erdogan years. Now, we have to see things in comparative perspective. Before Erdogan came to power in 1990s, Turkey went through arguably one of its worst decades, a decade marked by three economic crises, one of which was Turkey's worst in its modern history. Fighting against the PKK that resulted in massive human rights violations and huge material costs to the country, of course. And of course, corruption of the elites. The economy collapsed as a result of that mismanagement of the economy, as well as figuring that in. And so what brought Erdogan to power was the decade in which Turkey's political elites completely went bankrupt. So it was believable when Erdogan said that the country's problems should be blamed on its 20th century Kemalist elites. But that message no more sells. That's where I think Erdogan's nativist populism has kind of run into a wall. There was a time when people who remember 20th century Turkey could relate to Erdogan's message that he shouldn't be blamed for problems regarding Kurdish issue, corruption, economic mismanagement. 20 years into Erdogan rule, even the most ardent Erdogan supporters don't buy that or can't buy that, because guess what? For every citizen in Turkey, Erdogan owns Turkey's problems. These problems are back from the Kurdish issue to corruption to economic mismanagement to economic crisis. And so when he goes around and says, hey, I'm not to blame for these issues, I think even the most diehard Erdogan fan probably takes it with a pinch of salt. So I wonder if there's a point where nativist populist tactics kind of reach a saturation point, because the anti-elitist component of it, of these policies don't work. And on top of it, I wonder if there's also a place where the nativist part of the policy reaches a saturation point. Here's how it goes. Erdogan has been very good about demonizing, brutalizing, and cracking down on demographics unlikely to vote for him. But unlike, let's say, Trump, who went after all the groups at the same time, Erdogan went after these groups methodically. Right, he picked one, secularists, who I would say constitute about a quarter of Turkey's population. And by secularists, I don't mean secular. Secularists, as in those who want to have no religion in education or government or public policy, about a quarter of Turkey's population. He went after this group, and he made everybody else feel like they were his allies and that So he had support of liberals, socialists, Kurdish nationalists, social democrats in this endeavor. But once he locked up secularists in the infamous Ergenekon case with help from the Gulen movement, Erdogan moved on to demonize other groups. And I went to liberals, social democrats, and leftists. But if you add these groups up, together with Kurdish nationalists and Alevis, Alevis being a liberal branch of Islam in Turkey, similar to the Unitarian Church in Christianity, the Alevis constitute about 10-15% of Turkey. Once you add these groups up, secularists, social democrats, leftists, liberals, Alevis, Kurdish nationalists, you get over half of Turkey's population. That's why I think, yes, Erdogan has a base that loves him, but Erdogan has also built a constituency, a majority that hates him. And because of the economy collapsing, many centrist voters who would have typically voted for not based on ideology, but on pocketbook, are now abandoning the Erdogan camp. So I think he's got a huge problem. Neither his nativist populist elitist politics are working, nor the economy is delivering. And there's no way Erdogan can sustain a majority, sustain a plurality, let alone a majority in this environment. So we're at a turning point regarding Erdogan's career. You could argue that he built a base that loves him and that that was at times nearing a majority. He had that supported him. And he was able to govern in the first decade of his reign in Turkey. And then in the second decade, control and oppress the rest of the population by relying on this slim majority, definitely a plurality that supported him. Now, it's a minority that backs him, and he has to oppress the majority by relying on minority support. That has never happened in Turkey. Turkey has been a democracy since 1950. It just doesn't work. So when I put it together, I say this is not a sustainable model given Turkey's democratic resilience and traditions, and I just don't see how this will work out for Erdogan going forward.
So I think I agree with all of that. I mean, it's interesting. I meet businessmen here in Istanbul who've been on a bit of a political journey over the last kind of 5 years, who were quite keen supporters of Erdogan back in, say, 2015 and made their money in the 2010s, but have slowly seen their businesses kind of fade and pause, and quite a lot of these people are now abstaining or actively voting against it. I think it's reasonable to suggest that there's a majority of voters in Turkey that could be against Erdogan, but that's not quite the same thing as getting an opposition candidate over the line. In your book, you argue that his survival is probable. Explain why you think he's going to continue despite not having a majority of the population behind him anymore.
So typically, Luke, when Turkish presidents or leaders leave office, they retire to the Mediterranean or a nice villa in Istanbul's Anatolian side and pick up fun hobbies such as painting. I don't think that's an option Erdogan is going to be given if he ever loses elections. That's because he has stepped on so many toes, brutalized so many people. And in the Ergenekon case, so many people died in jail while they were waiting to see a judge that it's almost certain, and given that there are corruption allegations against him and his family, it's almost certain at this stage that if Erdogan ever loses power or is false from power, he'll be both prosecuted and potentially persecuted. And he knows that. So I think he has decided that losing elections is not an option, and he'll cling onto power by hook or by crook. We just talked about how Erdogan has lost plurality, leave alone, of course, majority support, and he has to rely on a minority to govern the oppress, in this case, unfortunately, the rest of the population. So it's almost he's relying on a third of the population to control and oppress two-thirds of the population. Not a sustainable model unless Erdogan unleashes new and unforeseen amounts of ideological and political oppression of the opposition. So I think his game plan going forward is going to include a lot more oppression than we have seen, but also some fine political gerrymandering, such as establishing new electoral thresholds that would benefit his allies and parties that support him in the elections, while undermining representation of support parties that oppose him. But these have to be so gerrymandered and so hocus pocus, I don't know that it works. So Erdogan has an ally, a small Turkish nationalist faction called MHP. And he also has a number of smaller parties that oppose him. So if you're setting up thresholds that benefit one smaller party while undermining support and representation of other smaller parties, that does look hocus pocus. I don't know that these things work in Turkey. You know, I think Turkey, one of the things that lessons and takeaways of Erdogan years in Turkey, I guess, is that opposite of the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan, where the takeaway would be it takes a really long time to build a democracy. I guess the lesson of Turkey under Erdogan is that it also takes a really long time to kill one. So is Erdogan autocratic? Yes. Is Turkey a dictatorship? No. I think that one of the fascinating parts of studying Turkey for me is that I believe if countries could be vegetables, Turkey would be the analytical onion. What is the analytical onion? It doesn't have a core. It defies Manichaean binarisms and broad generalizations. So Turkey is neither a democracy nor a dictatorship. It's a democracy that has fallen under an autocrat. And in this alignment, democratic traditions are so robust and memory so thick and democracy is so resilient that, you know, when you try to do hocus pocus and gerrymander tactics, electorate simply doesn't buy these things. It happened in Istanbul. Erdogan lost elections for mayor in 2019 by a very narrow margin. He said, oh, I can repeat the elections and I control all the institutions and I can win the second round. Guess what? The electorate humbled him in the second round. This time, his candidate lost the elections by a margin of nearly 1 million votes compared to 13,000. Very significant margin, of course, in a city of 15 million people. So he's going to have problems. I think he's going to move the goalposts further for the opposition, gerrymander the electoral system. Don't know that it will work. So I think the only way he can go forward, he might set up fake opposition parties to steal votes from the opposition, support these parties so they look like they're genuine. But nothing will work, in my view, short of robust economic growth. And robust economic growth in Turkey doesn't mean 4%. Turkey is a young and dynamic population. For economic growth to feel like prosperity has come back, it has to grow close to double digits. I don't know that's deliverable. If it is, of course, Erdogan can hope to rebuild his base. So I think even by the standards of Erdogan years of the last decade, where Turkey has been in political crisis between the supporters and opponents and increased amount of oppression, I would say buckle up for the next part of the ride. It's going to be really rough. This leader who realizes he can't fall from power will do everything to stay in charge by hook or by crook. But then Turkey's democratic resilience and traditions will kick back. I agree with you on one point, though. There is yet no one leader that unifies the opposition. And that's, for the moment, Erdogan's strength.
I have a lot of thoughts based on what you've just said. And of course, the other key of Erdogan's survival is his continued stranglehold over the media. I mean, we've recently seen these efforts to attempt to get foreign money out of media, which just looks like a stick to beat the last few remaining independent media institutions in Turkey. But I want to move on and talk about the mayoral elections, because those were fascinating, because they really, Erdogan had built up the sort of legend in this sort of the mind of the opposition of being unbeatable, almost like was pulled off magic tricks every single time. And to be defeated so thoroughly in both Istanbul and Ankara was quite dramatic. You, in your book, you write about Mayor Ekrem İmamoğlu as a possible candidate to take on Erdogan in the next presidential election. And you talk about his kind of distinctive style of politics as possibly being an interesting counterpoint to Erdogan's style. Could you walk me through that?
Absolutely. As you said, Erdogan's brand for a very long time was good governance and invincible. You know, he delivered good governance, especially regarding the economy, an invincible politician, because you just could not defeat him. You know, the opposition ran its best campaigns. Erdogan defeated the main opposition party, Republican People's Party, CHP, at times by a margin of 20 percent points. That's huge. And that's when elections were free and the race was fair. Now, the race is no more fair, I think. Erdogan does control almost the entire spectrum of conventional media. So as you argued, you know, these efforts have now turned into controlling new forms of media. I don't know if it will be successful because, as I said, democratic traditions really matter, and an autocratic leader simply cannot shut down a democracy as old as Turkey. Turkey has held elections longer than Spain has. And so I think memory and resilience in terms of democratic traditions is really important to challenge Erdogan. But the issue is, can some leader, can one leader mobilize this resilience and memory and turn it into action and vote Erdogan out? Until recently, that didn't look likely, but Istanbul Mayor İmamoğlu, who won Istanbul, of course, from Erdogan's party, representing the opposition, I think, and others, Ankara Mayor as well, I think they did a fantastic job. And I wonder if this is also showing the path forward for politicians challenging nativist populist leaders elsewhere. For a very long time, Turkey's opposition fought Erdogan on using the same nativist populist rhetoric to attack him and his base. That didn't work. Opposition lost by margins of 20 percent points and even bigger. İmamoğlu and others embraced a new tactic labeled radical love. It's not what it sounds like politically. Basically, it means ignore the populist leader and love the base that votes for him. And I think that's the only way you can defeat a nativist populist leader, not by fighting him and his base, embracing his base, but ignoring him. Although Erdogan wanted to pull the opposition mayor candidates into a mud race, a slinging race, opposition never fell for it. Instead, the opposition leaders reached out to Erdogan's base. İmamoğlu spent more time in Istanbul's conservative, lower middle and working class neighborhoods that typically vote for Erdogan than in middle class and liberal neighborhoods. Model has, I think, been copied by other mayors elsewhere. So I think İmamoğlu is quite a significant challenger to Erdogan at this stage. So the issue, of course, is İmamoğlu is Istanbul's mayor, which is a very important post in Turkey. I think being a successful mayor in Turkey is the equivalent of being a successful governor of a state in the US or a senator. If you do your job well, it makes you presidential material. Mm-hmm. So if İmamoğlu runs Istanbul efficiently, delivers services well, he will rise in the eyes of the electorate. Enter Erdogan's or Turkey's political system where local governments rely on central government for 2/3 of their budget. So I think what Erdogan has been doing is, squeezing a lifeline for İmamoğlu by eliminating funding for his projects. And to the extent that İmamoğlu can bypass these limitations and deliver good governance and run Istanbul well, I think he's going to rise in the eyes of the public. But there are others who could fill that role. I think Ankara Mayor Yavaş, who's slightly more centrist than İmamoğlu in his politics, comes from a nationalist background. He hails from MHP, Nationalist Action Party, is therefore kind of probably more appealing to the right, could be another candidate. He's also been running Ankara quite well. And I would also throw a third candidate, and that's Meral Akşener, the leader of E Party. In Turkish, in English, that would be Good Party. Mm-hmm. E Party is also comes from the Turkish nationalist tradition. That's quite important. So it's a right-wing party. Why is that important? Between the time it became a multi-party democracy in 1950 and today, excluding years spent under military rule, totaling four, Turkey has had democratically elected governments for the last 67 years. Guess of those 67 years, how many years were spent under left-wing led governments? Not even years, 17 months.
It's not very long.
Correct. So basically, there's a fact, Turkey is a right-wing country, and Erdogan's opposition has to have a right-wing component to it to attract right-wing voters and have mainstream legitimacy. Enter Akşener. She comes from the right. She's a practicing Muslim, but also secular. So she checks a lot of boxes. She's Anatolian. She doesn't represent the Istanbul elites necessarily in the eyes of the electorate. That was also Erdogan's brand when he came to power. So I would look at Akşener, İmamoğlu, and Yavaş, a leader of MHP. Akşener, obviously, she split up from the Turkish nationalist ally of Erdogan and set up her own party. And the party has been increasing support very, gradually, but also persistently. Polls show her party to be at around 14-15%. I would say she's a politician to watch. İmamoğlu, of course, is an important politician to watch, because if you run Istanbul well in Turkey, you become presidential material. And Ankara Mayor Yavaş, I guess, because of his deliverance of good services and good performance. So I think I wouldn't rule out the game of democracy to be over in Turkey. There are pessimists who look at it who say, oh, come on, it doesn't matter anymore. Elections are not fair. Elections will not be fair, but they'll be free the day of elections. Again, taking into account the lessons of Istanbul, repeat race, right? Erdogan canceled the first election in Istanbul, in which his candidate lost by a margin of 13,000 votes, saying, I control the race, I control electoral bodies, I control the media, I'll win it. In the second round, the electorate humbled him. He lost by 800,000 votes, nearly 1 million vote margin. It's a huge margin. How did it happen? A lot of people who voted for him in the first round said, no, that's not right. You lost it. This is a democracy. You got to respect it. They stepped down. But also, the opposition organized an amazing campaign to prevent rigging, which could not happen, let's say, in Putin's Russia. 100,000 volunteers descended onto ballot stations. They tallied the votes, you know, collated them into PDF files, and they slept on top of ballot boxes to prevent rigging. So again, using analogies, I get this question a lot. People say, is Turkey like Russia? Is Erdogan like Putin? I think Erdogan has a political man crush on Putin. You know, after the March elections, when his party lost, a friend said, Putin called Erdogan. What do you think he told him? And did he congratulate him? I said, no, of course, Putin called Erdogan to say, how do you lose elections? It doesn't happen in my system. So Turkey is not like Russia.
No, I think your comparison.
If you want to come.
Sorry.
No, please go ahead.
No, I think your comparison with Viktor Orban in Hungary is a much better one.
Yeah, I think so. I would say if you're going to compare Turkey to a country, it's Hungary and Poland, right? Where similarly, nativist populist leaders have taken over democracies. These countries are democracies that have fallen under autocrats, but opposition is resilient. And just as it happened in Turkey, where opposition took Istanbul, Ankara from the autocratic leader, in Hungary and Poland too, opposition has done similar achievements, taking Budapest and Warsaw from those countries, similarly autocratic leaders.
The other thing that's similar, and I include Israel in this, is you're starting to see quite odd coalitions that of not sort of natural allies getting together to remove autocratic leaders. I mean, again, Israel's the obvious comparison here, where people on complete opposite ends of the spectrum were able to get together. And it makes the possibility of, say, for example, Kurdish nationalist parties and Turkish nationalist parties kind of get like MHP and HDP continuing to work together, even though there are some pretty irreconcilable differences between the two parties.
That's correct. I think that the only way for the opposition to defeat Erdogan is if its three key components stay together. The central wing of the opposition is CHP, Republican People's Party, main opposition party. They're not going anywhere. The issue is whether the two wings of the opposition bloc will stay together. One wing of the opposition bloc is pro-Kurdish Liberal Alliance, HDP, People's Democracy Party. The other wing is Akşener's Turkish Nationalist E-Party, Good Party. I think Erdogan's game is to demonize the HDP in the run-up to the elections, you know, label them as quote-unquote terrorists, in order not to push the HDP, but the Akşener's E-Party out of the electoral alliance, just by demonstrating to her base that their party is in coalition with quote-unquote terrorists. So I see Erdogan's attacks on HDP, court case to ban the HDP, a constant, you know, stigmatization of that party, an effort to push Akşener's E-Party out of the opposition bloc. Here's the fact.
Sorry, I think you're right, but I think there might be another motivation there as well. I mean, that if again, one of the things you point out in your book is that Erdogan's not trying to win by 60%, right? He's trying to win by 1%. And I think if you close down HDP, which seems to be the direction they want to go, you might get a couple of thousand Kurdish voters or so who decide not to vote. And it's more about not giving Kurdish voters someone who they can support, and that would just like reduce the opposition a little bit. Do you think that's wrong, or do you think that's part of it?
No, I think that Erdogan's, and there are different views on this. I don't think that Erdogan will shut down HDP for the elections. I think that he knows that that will cost conservative Kurdish voters. You know, remember Turkey's Kurdish community,
okay, yeah.
about 18-20% of Turkey's population is split almost three ways in blocks of descending order. The largest block votes for HDP, traditionally leftist. The second largest block votes for Erdogan, conservative, mostly lives in big cities in the West. And the third block, smallest, I guess, are Kurds who are integrated or feel that they have hyphenated identities and do not vote based on ethnic identity. So of these blocks, the second block voting for Erdogan loves Erdogan, but they'll be offended if Erdogan shuts down a Kurdish party just because it's the Kurdish party. And I think he knows that. So I think Erdogan's game is more about demonizing HDP, kind of keeping the sword of Damocles dangling on the HDP's head, labeling and stigmatizing the party as quote-unquote terrorist in order to force Akşener to jettison herself out of the opposition bloc. Here's the fact. If there's a two-way race, as was the case in Istanbul in 2019, Erdogan won't win. There's no way. When you put numbers together, there's no way he can get to 50%. I think one of his gravest mistakes to date, political mistakes, that is, was the switch to presidential system, which eliminated a multi-party race and put in place instead a two-way race. That not only encouraged the opposition to unify, but also means that Erdogan has to get 50. And it's almost impossible for him to do that in Turkey, especially given where the economy stands. So he wants to create, Luke, in my view, a three-way race once again. He wants to force Akşener and maybe other smaller right-wing parties, Babacan's and Davutoğlu's parties, to abandon the opposition bloc and run as a third pole. Erdogan loses in a two-way race, wins in a three-way race. I think that's his goal going forward.
Let me tell you what worries me about the direction I could possibly see Turkish politics going in. I think that, as we've been talking about, there is this majority that could quite conceivably win an election in Turkey right now. So, but what happens if Erdogan decides not to go? I mean, he played with this with the mayorals. It didn't work out for him, but there wasn't as much at stake in the mayorals. It wasn't his career. And as you said earlier, his concerns about possible prosecution. So is this a real concern that I should be having, or is it am I being a bit paranoid?
I think it's a real concern. There's a very high possibility that Erdogan might decide to go for elections thinking he'll win, as happened in Istanbul in 2019, and that the electorate might humble him, notwithstanding Erdogan's control of institutions. And it's very likely that if that happens, Erdogan will pull what I call pulling a Trump. He will say, oh, I didn't lose the elections, they were rigged. He'll call his supporters to the streets. And so there's a high chance of political instability, driven by Erdogan's agenda to stay in power by hook or by crook. And what happens then is a complete, unknown to me. Turkey has never seen this. Turkey has never seen a leader not accept defeat. Turkey has had dozens of peaceful transitions of power through the ballot box. Leaders, even when they most fear persecution, including Yılmaz and Çiller in the 1990s, never accept defeat. So it would be a complete, can of worms that Erdogan would open up. It's very likely that Erdogan might therefore decide to hold elections at a time of his peaking, when his popularity has peaked. I think that would take at least a year from today. So hoping that he will deliver strong growth, which is where the foreign policy part of the puzzle comes in. He has, notwithstanding Erdogan's efforts to turn Turkey's face to the Middle East and bring Islam to the centerfold of society, there's a fact. Turkey's economy is completely integrated to the European economy because of customs union that goes back to 1995. And as a resource-poor country, Turkey needs financial inflows to grow. So Erdogan needs Europe and the United States. But he also needs Russia to avoid economic and trade sanctions that could undermine his growth domestically, especially if there are tourism sanctions, given that Russians are number one arrivals to Turkey. If they were before COVID, they would be again after COVID, of course, the pandemic. And he also has to Erdogan cultivate China because I think he's trying to break ground with this massive project called Canal Istanbul, mm-hmm. which is, there's a big debate over it in terms of environmental damage. In fact, if I can use this as a sidebar, I think that, the greatest part of Erdogan's notorious legacy in Turkey is going to be environmental degradation and damage. Yeah, and the canal would do that to Istanbul's forests. But he's going to want to break ground with it because he knows that a mega project will jumpstart the economy, will add 1 or 2% points of growth. And only the Chinese are willing to invest in this, apparently. So he's got to cultivate good relationships with Turkey's East, China, North Russia, and West EU and US. So he might, if he has strong growth, decide to go for elections or pressing the opposition further. So at that point, it's really a question of how effective the opposition is organized, whether they can be so good at preventing rigging. I think they will be. I think that Erdogan maybe can rig elections by half a point, but not by 5 or 10 points, if that's what the margin is like. So there's a high possibility that even in this scenario, he might be humbled by the electorate and he might pull a Trump. And that point, since I'm in Washington, I'm also looking at things from the US perspective. it'd be impossible for the Biden administration, after what transpired in the U.S. in January this year, to turn its head the other way if Erdogan pulls a Trump. Mm-hmm. So I think that's going to be a point of reckoning for Biden administration. Washington will pick democracy and not Erdogan, which is a huge, huge shift from earlier policies where the view from Washington was always, Turkey's a strategic ally. We deal with whoever is on top. Yes, of course, democracy is important. But at this stage, I think it's going to have a more pivotal role in U.S. policy towards Turkey.
Yeah, I worry that some of the noise you hear coming out of the American right are going to be repeated by authoritarians around the world in the next few years, and that there's quite a bit of irreparable damage being done to democracies that won't be felt in America, but will be felt in other countries more keenly. I want to touch on that environmental point, because I think that's a really interesting one. I feel that that's almost an unguarded flank for Erdogan. It's ground he's not used to defending himself on. But there's also been this drumbeat of like environmental stories. I mean, as we speak, there's quite severe wildfires. This year, the Marmara Sea became polluted by sea mucilage. And there are just constant stories about people going out walking and finding like a valley full of dumped asbestos. Do you think that that's actually going to be an issue that could hurt Erdogan over the next few years, or is it sort of interesting but not relevant?
No, I think it's interesting. I think, Luke, there are two issues where Erdogan faces a nonpartisan opposition regarding the environment and regarding gender equality. I think on these two issues, there's consensus across Turkish society. You know, 60-70% even more opposed Turkey withdrawing from Istanbul Convention that was meant to provide violence against women and other sexual minorities. And similarly, overwhelming majorities also oppose Kanal Istanbul, you know, 70-80% mm-hmm. regardless, depending on which poll you look at. So I think that Erdogan, for the opposition, environment and gender equality are two issues where they can build a coalition, including with Erdogan voters. And I think those are the unguarded flanks of Erdogan's kind of ideological domination of Turkey. So good luck to him. I think if he tries to brush these under the carpet. I was thinking earlier about Erdogan's legacy, because now we're at a point of that. His popularity is not going to go back to what it used to be. And it's very hard for him to stay in power through democratic means. And I don't think his legacy is going to be about Islam anymore. I think his legacy is going to be about the degradation of the environment under his rule, and also increasingly a sloppy public administration. It's just fascinating to me to see that Turkey, a country that has really good kind of public administration system, is suffering from remiss public administration, whether it's their inability to fight forest fires or the way lockdowns during COVID were mismanaged, erratic lockdown schedules announced last minute. You live in Turkey, you probably saw this. People mm-hmm. were not sure if they could go to the bakers, if they could, what days. Very chaotic. And I think those to me are signs of remiss public administration. So it's not going to be the ideology, but it's going to be more managing environment and managing public administration that are going to be the hallmarks of the last era of Erdogan years in Turkey.
It keeps reminding me how important those mayoral elections really were, because with all of that stuff, it gives the opposition a chance to have a better record of administration on environmental policy. I mean, I live here in Istanbul, right, and I'm bombarded by messages from İBB about, the Istanbul municipality, showing, people with spades making a new park or something like that. And also, the mayor's been pretty successful in getting investment from European capitals. And if he does decide to run against Erdogan, we don't know, but if he does, he's going to have a record of success to give a direct comparison, which the previous candidate didn't really have.
That's correct. You could argue that what made Erdogan a nationally known figure was term as Istanbul's mayor in 1990s, when he really cleaned up Istanbul and ran it well. I was raised in Istanbul. I lived in Istanbul at the time. The city was collapsing under its mayor who preceded Erdogan. Public services, as basic as water, were not available. And the city was collapsing under the burden of population boom. Erdogan did a phenomenal job cleaning it up, improving services. And that's what made him presidential in the eyes of the public. So I think Mayor Mamul has a real chance if he can establish himself as that person who delivers good governance and also keeps onto his strategy of radical love, you know, reaching out to Erdogan's base, but ignoring Erdogan. Erdogan, of course, can cut his financial lifelines because the mayor relies on Ankara government run by Erdogan for 2/3 of the city's budget. But as you mentioned, European banks have been quite generous in providing credit to Istanbul so that the mayor can finish some of these waiting metro line projects. They're very important. I would say Istanbul's number one for its citizens is transportation, getting around a city of 15 million people on two continents. You need to have a really good public transportation system. So I think if the mayor can deliver 2, 3, 4 new metro lines by the time of the next elections, he'll probably win. If he can't, it would be difficult for him to compete with Erdogan. And it looks so far that he's on track for that. So it will be interesting to watch. I think the nitty-gritty story of Turkish politics is going to be how many metro lines the mayor opens up in the next 3 years, because that will probably determine to what extent his support is going to go up in the elections.
I was just thinking there, there's a real element of tragedy to Erdogan's career in some ways, because he comes into office, as you said, as the new mayor of Istanbul. And one of his first achievements is sort of cleaning up the Halic. And sort of, and now in 2021, he's president and the whole Marmara Sea is polluted. It's sad when you think of it like that.
It's correct. I would say, we never thought an environment would be such a big issue in Turkey. But in addition to the environment, I think the degradation of the cities, but also Turkey's cultural heritage in general, is going to be a part of Erdogan's kind of notorious legacy. You know, it's ironic because this is a party, Erdogan's movement, that has come to power saying that it will embrace Turkey's Ottoman heritage. But it's a party that has probably done most damage physically to Turkey's Ottoman heritage. I was recently in Istanbul. I love the city. I'm a big fan of its mosques and hills. And I went to Üsküdar Square on the Anatolian side. This is probably one of Istanbul's most picturesque Ottoman era squares. Mm-hmm. You know, it had was paved with stones and was surrounded by beautiful mosques. And I went to the square. It was paved with cement. And there was a huge ventilation shaft for the metro station in the middle of it. And to me, that's more damage to Istanbul's built Ottoman legacy than anybody could imagine. And ironic that the damage comes under the party that said that it was going to embrace that legacy. So I wonder sometimes to what extent that's going to be part of Erdogan's positive legacy going forward, and to what extent he's going to be remembered, you know, as the person under whom Istanbul lost much of its Ottoman charm, which has now been isolated to a few pockets here and there.
Okay, so thinking forward to another possible future, I realize this is maybe more speculative than you would like, but I've been thinking about the career of Menderes a lot recently, and the way he died, and the shady circumstances surrounding his execution, and the way that Menderes was seen to be tried and executed after he was taken out of power, it set the seeds of the resentment that would eventually lead, I think it's not unreasonable to say that a lot of that would feed into the Erdogan administration so many years later. If Erdogan loses an election, as you mentioned earlier, there's going to be a feeling amongst a lot of people that there's going to want to be justice for things that happened during his administration. But I think that that runs the risk of looking like revenge to supporters of the president. And we could very much end up in just setting the cycle going again. How do you think a new opposition government, if they win, should proceed with sort of sorting out the baggage?
I could not agree more. I think that notwithstanding the legacy of the Erdogan years, the crackdowns, people arrested and kept in jail for years, lives ruined, opposition has to come up with a graceful exit strategy for Erdogan. If they were to win the election, or it looks like they are going to win. That graceful exit, in my view, has to include elements of immunity to Erdogan, his family, his administration. I know this is a very controversial topic in Turkey. There's a lot of anger on both sides. It's a completely polarized political environment. But I think for Turkey to move forward, it needs to kind of have a cool-off period after the Erdogan era, if it were Erdogan to fall from power, and that has to include a commitment by the opposition if it looks like they're going to win or they have just won and Erdogan is going to, you know, declare fraud in order to steal his thunder. They have to basically tell his base, you know, this is not a dog-eat-dog world. This is not Hunger Games. I know it's not about revenge. It's about moving forward. So sometimes I'm more optimistic about that possibility emerging. I think, Luke, that the debate in Turkey from the time of first the free and fair elections, 1950, I'd say roughly around the 1980 coup, was whether democracy paired with American capitalism was the best form of governance. The left objected to that. And there was civil war, like fighting on the streets in 1970s by people who said, we don't want capitalism, we don't want democracy. That ended with the 1980 coup, forcefully, unfortunately so. And the next debate, I think, became after 1980. Now that everybody agreed, most everyone agreed democracy is the best form of governance, that people did not agree that they want the same rights and liberties they had for their opposition. So Turkey was kind of political tribes. You had secularists, Islamists, Kurdish nationalists, Turkish nationalists. They all opposed each other. They said, no, I want rights for my own group. I deny rights to your group. So I wonder if the takeaway of the Erdogan years, you know, 20 years after Erdogan has been in power and Erdogan has served secularists formerly in charge their own bitter medicine, if they'll take this medicine in the right place and they'll basically say, look, democracy doesn't work if you deny your opposition the rights and liberties you have. So to the extent that you have consensus where different political parties and factions agree that, you know, this should not be another round of persecutions because that's how the Erdogan era is seen as persecution of the secularist elites, that this, to the extent that this is not seen as another round of persecutions, I think Turkey can move forward. I'm hopeful, I guess, because I think that many people in Turkey have taken this lesson from the Erdogan era, that maybe this time the country can move forward. Why am I hopeful? The alliance that we are seeing challenging Erdogan was inconceivable five years ago, that you would have a Turkish Nationalist Party and the Kurdish Nationalist Party in the same block with a secularist party and the political Islamist party. You know, the four tribes of Turkey have come together in an alliance to vote Erdogan out, and that those four tribes in the past hated each other, would not even sit down together for a conversation. Now they're actually in an informal, as it be, alliance trying to vote him out. So is it ironically Erdogan's autocratic rule that has forced Turkey's political tribes to agree that, yes, they're different, but they should not deny rights to each other? And if that's the case, then I'm hoping that we're going to have a consensus in the post-Erdogan era where Turkey will move into the third phase of its democracy journey. If the first phase was 1950 to 1980, where the debate was whether democracy was the best form, if the second phase was, yes, it's the best form, but only for my tribe, the third phase will be, it's the best form for everyone. So I'm hoping we're going to get there.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. My very last question for you. In your book, you make the case rightly that the way that European and American leaders approach Erdogan has to be very careful, because if they get into sort of public feuds with him, it's very easy for him to spin that as, oh, the West hates us, Europe and America hates us, you can only trust me. So how do you think that European and American leaders should approach Erdogan over the next few years?
I think that just as the opposition has learned its lesson that to engage and defeat a nativist populist leader, you should avoid fighting him on nativist populist territory and instead reach out to his base and not target the leader. I think that Turkey's Western allies, for the most part, too, have learned a similar lesson. You know, earlier they would bash Erdogan on any policy and Erdogan would take it to his base and say, you see, I was right. They hate us. They don't want Turkey to be great and Muslims to rise again. Only I can do that. That's why they're attacking me. I think that Turkey's Western allies, US and Germany and others, have learned this lesson. And they've been very quiet regarding Erdogan's transgressions. For instance, when he converted Hagia Sophia to a mosque, the criticism was quite muted. And I think Erdogan was not able to use that to mobilize his base. So I would say Turkey's Western allies, too, have to embrace the policy of radical love, ignoring Erdogan, but reaching out to electorates that vote for him and that do not vote for him, and really reaching out to the Turkish public more so than dealing with the government. And there are exceptions, of course. I think Greece, because of its proximity to Turkey, often criticizes Erdogan quite viscerally. And I think until recently, Macron, because of the increasing tensions between Turkey and France over East Med and Libya, where the two countries were fighting on different sides of the civil war, but also driven by Macron's own agenda. He doesn't want to be outflanked by Le Pen's right-wing movement. He was also quite critical, but I think we're also seeing that the French are now embracing perhaps what I would call radical love. So I think going forward, Erdogan does not have the ability anymore to take Western European and American criticism of his policies and to reframe these as attacks on Turkey and Muslims. So to the extent that public diplomacy policy attitude and outreach of Turkey's European and NATO allies is fine-tuned to be criticizing Erdogan, but not the Turkish government, not the Turkish state or Turkish citizenry, I think that that public diplomacy outreach can be considered successful.
All right, thank you very much. Just to close us off, beyond your books, what would you recommend for some further reading to the audience?
Yeah, I love Jenny White's books. She's a great author and also a novelist. She's
got a new comic
fiction.
Out. That's great.
Very, very good. Definitely a go-to person in terms of books. I would also recommend Sinan Ulgen's and Aslı Aydıntaşbaş's analysis on Turkey. They're both columnists. They write frequently for think tanks and international media.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Luke. Thanks for hosting me. And I really appreciate that you hosted me today.
Thanks. All right.